Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and National Grassroots and Outreach Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. I'll be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Ashley Hunt, a partner in the Iowa-based PR and government affairs firm, LS2. We'll be discussing the Iowa caucus, go a little deeper into the Congressional Budget Office baseline numbers from last week's budget outlook to discuss what is facing the next presidential term, as well as CBO's analysis of workforce productivity numbers. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that the Trump administration notified Congress it may need to reprogram $136 million to bolster its response to the coronavirus outbreak. For now, the administration is relying on $105 million that Congress has set aside in recent years to respond to infectious disease emergencies. But the Health and Human Services Department told Congress that it may need to transfer more money for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and other agencies leading the response. The price tag of an emergency aid package for Puerto Rico has grown to $20.8 billion over 10 years, according to the Congressional Budget Office and the Joint Committee on Taxation. Appropriators last week unveiled a $4.67 billion spending package to help Puerto Rico recover from recent earthquakes, but the bill also included tax breaks whose costs had not yet been calculated. Those tax breaks would add $16.1 billion to annual deficits over the coming decade, the CBO and JCT said in a cost estimate issued this week. A tight cap on non-defense spending for the coming fiscal year may now have a little more wiggle room. If new projections from the Congressional Budget Office are correct, appropriators may have an extra $3 billion to play with in fiscal year 2021, thanks to an unexpected increase in receipts from housing loan programs. And that windfall from the Federal Housing Administration could ease the strain on congressional purse strings caused by the growing costs of veterans' health care. The FHA loan program has been aided by lower-than-anticipated interest rates. Up next, I'll be joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. We'll be discussing the CBO budget outlook and how it applies to whoever is in the White House come 2021. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. Bob, you know well, he's a regular contributor on the show, and we're picking up this week on last week's show a little bit, where we focused on the recent economic and budget outlook the Congressional Budget Office had published. I wanted to turn our focus to a portion of that report, and that is the next 4 or 5 years, what the next president or what the second term of President Trump would look like in terms of the fiscal policy issues they're going to be facing, the underlying trends, and how that's going to impact decision making. So maybe before we get into that aspect of the conversation, you can give a quick reminder for our listeners of what we're even talking about. What are the CBO baseline figures? What is the budget outlook?
Well, every January, CBO produces what it's called its budget and economic outlook. And they, as the title would suggest, they look at the budget and make a projection of where spending and revenues will end up if Congress makes no changes. And then they look at that relative to their economic outlook, and they come up with an estimate of what the budget deficit will be for each year for the next 10 years and how that would affect the overall debt. And Congress got the CBO report on January 28th. And so that's the they call that the baseline because that is the kind of the benchmark on which new legislation will be written. You know, will show if they're going to spend more or cut taxes. It will be relative to this baseline.
And I know we're talking about a 10-year window here for this particular report by CBO, but you wanted to take a closer look of what maybe what 2021 to 2025 might look like for either a new president or a second term for President Trump. So can you give us some more detailed information on maybe what the trends are for those 4 years and what the deficits look like? What's reality going to be, or what could reality be for the next president or a second term for President Trump?
Well, reality may be harsh. I think that it's good to think about that because when we look at the baseline, sometimes we look at the first year because it's the year we're in, and naturally that gets a lot of attention. Or we look at the big 10-year number, which gets, you know, really scary if you lump it all together. But for all of the folks running around New Hampshire and for the president, a more relevant period is what's going to happen in that next 4 years when the president, whoever that is, takes the oath of office in January 2021. So the first budget that the president will present, this president or somebody else replacing him, that will be for fiscal year 2022. President Trump will present a 2021 budget next week. And then they'll so the next president will be submitting a 2022 budget in January of next year. And so the budget deficit projected for those 4 years, they're all over $1 trillion. And so for 2022, 23, 24, and 25, by 2025, you're looking at a deficit of $1.3 trillion and knocking on the door of 5% of GDP, 4.9% of GDP. So what's confronting all of the candidates and President Trump is a 4 years of unusually high budget deficits and trending up a little bit higher, with spending definitely growing at a faster rate than revenues. And so that is what that next president is going to have to face. Just as a baseline, just going in. Growing budget deficits are not surprising given the fact that nobody has done anything about them for several years, except make them worse. So instead of either reducing spending or raising revenue to pay for it, we have increased spending and cut taxes. But the important thing is this is not a problem that's caused by the economy, which is something that has caused very large deficits and debt spikes in the past. This is a policy problem. The economy is doing what it can, but and it's very, very unusual to have these very large deficits in a period of economic growth and very low unemployment. That's a highly unusual situation that we've gotten ourselves into. And it's basically because of poor policy choices.
And I do want to get into something you just mentioned, and that is the economy doing the best that it can a little bit later on in this segment, because CBO gave some analysis on workforce productivity, labor force engagement, I believe, and wanted to pick your brain on that. But before we do, I'm curious. So this is a 10-year window for CBO's budget outlook. We're talking about the first term or next term for the president, which is only a 4-year window, and that's coming up pretty quickly. What can elected leaders do in that short period of time to help address these issues? I mean, is it realistic to see these trends reverse in that time frame, or is it really just about taking those first steps and getting us on at least a better, more responsible path?
Well, I would settle for taking those first steps. It would be unrealistic to think that we're going to totally reverse these trends in a four-year period, but it will be very, very important for the next presidential budget, not the one that's coming out next week, but the one that will be presented in January 2021, to make this a priority. And perhaps in a pressing the reset button, hopefully trying to get some bipartisan support for efforts that would stabilize the situation so that the debt is not continually going up as a percentage of GDP. There's one big lever that comes into play right after this next 4 years. The tax bill that was passed in 2017 has a lot of provisions in it, most of them affecting individuals, that are scheduled to expire at the end of 2025. So if you're looking at fiscal year 2026, there's a big spike in revenues because it is assumed by CBO that those expiring tax cuts actually expire on schedule. Generally speaking, Congress will not allow that to happen. I mean, in the past, there have been big negotiations over tax cuts that have been scheduled to expire. So that provides that's going to provide one of those opportunities to have a negotiation about spending and tax policies, because nobody will want all of those tax cuts to expire all at once at the end of 2025. So it may be that towards the end of, and they ought to start working on something now, but they're going to have a negotiation about revenues, and that could bring into play some sort of negotiations about spending, maybe on healthcare, maybe on infrastructure, things that they might agree on. And hopefully the agreement won't be on let's keep cutting taxes and raising spending. Hopefully part of the agreement will be on things to restrain spending and bring in new revenue. But that's, it's not complicated, but that's the next logical pressure point that they're going to have to do something about.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. We are taking a closer look at some of the key CBO baseline figures from the latest 10-year budget outlook, specifically how it would apply to either the next president or a second term for President Trump. And we've been talking a little bit about what levers can be pulled or what pressure points are about to occur that might prompt change. So I guess I have this question eating at the back of my mind. How realistic is it that we could see change in those 4 years? And how likely is it from your vantage point that fiscal policy issues, or especially the deficit, will become sort of a top-tier issue again? It was 20 years ago. It sort of fell by the wayside, and there are a lot of key issues during this election, but you don't hear a lot about the debt and the deficit. Do you think that will change as we see year after year more than trillion-dollar deficits, Bob?
Well, I don't know. I guess that's our challenge. I would certainly not give up and say that nobody cares about this issue, so let's just forget about it. I think that would be an irresponsible thing to do, even though it does appear that leaders of both parties are doing exactly that. But I do think that here are a couple of other pressure points that people are going to care something about, aside from the tax cut expiring. They might even care even more about this, which is that, we've got a couple of major trust funds in the federal budget that are going to be running out of spending authority fairly soon. The Highway Trust Fund, the Medicare Part A Trust Fund, and in the not too distant future, the Social Security Trust Fund, both the old age and survivors portion, and a little bit later, the disability program. And, you know, those, if the practical effect of those running out of spending authorities is that the relevant agencies won't be able to issue the checks. And people will not react well to that. So, you know, that's another pressure point that Congress can begin to look at in the next 5 years. And I think, you know, when you start talking about, are your taxes going to go up suddenly? Is your Medicare going to be cut suddenly? Is your Social Security check not going to go out? Those are issues that do get people's attention. They're not at all esoteric. And so while politicians may be ignoring these issues for now, there are some, you know, some deadlines coming up that will be, as the phrase goes, action-forcing events. Now, they might not force action in the next 4 years, but the next president had better be prepared to deal with these issues because they're coming at us.
Yeah, that's a fair point, Bob, especially the concept of, you know, planning ahead. I would prefer that at least in the next 4 to 5 years, we're seeing some attention put on those issues and some plans introduced to prioritize them so that we're not waiting for, I guess, judgment day on some of those major issues where you might see a huge tax hike or a benefit cut, which, like you said, would not go over very well with anyone across the country. Something else that CBO covered in the budget outlook was some trends in workforce productivity. And I thought it would be a good topic to tie in today because we've, as an organization, also have a fiscally responsible economic growth agenda that we've introduced on a handful of topics. Can you give us a little bit of insight, Bob, on what CBO said about workforce productivity and how that might impact the economy? And then you can weave in, as you wish, how our economic growth agenda might fit into it.
Well, there are two main factors that drive economic growth. One is labor force growth, and the other is productivity. And you can kind of add those together and come up with what is the potential economic growth. The economy may or may not perform up to its potential, but economists tend to look at what are the input factors. And so we've talked about this on the show before, labor force growth has slowed dramatically over the past 20 years or so as the baby boomers begin to enter their retirement years. So, you know, CBO looks at historical data and workforce growth. If you want to go back to the 1980s and 1990s, the workforce growth was growing well over 1% a year, kind of like 1.5%, let's say, on average. And that is projected to be just a third of that, 0.5% in the next 10 years or so. And that's going to put downward pressure on economic growth. So those factors are kind of baked into the cake because of the demographics. Now you can change them by trying to encourage people to stay in the workforce longer. You can change it by changing immigration laws and allowing more people into the country who would help with their productive skills to grow the economy. But you also need to look at what can be done on the productivity side, that other side of the equation. And there, the story isn't quite as dire in the sense that productivity fluctuates a great deal. It's been rather stagnant recently since just before the Great Recession. Ticked up a little bit, and CBO is projecting that it's going to stay flat, you know, basically for the next few years. They're showing a slight improvement, but then gradually declining again because we're not doing enough to invest, and more potential investment capital is being diverted to financing our debt. So you got two factors going on there. One is more capital being used for the debt, and the other is that the federal government is just simply not spending as much on investment as it used to. That's a continuation of a long-term trend. So it doesn't fit well with a slowing workforce. With a slowing workforce, we have to hope for even better productivity. So the federal government really should be looking at ways to get more bang for the buck in the workforce, and that includes the education and training, by the way. One of our papers is on long-term, how the workforce has been changing, and people need lifelong learning and skills, and should be able to easily change jobs as needed, as necessary, go where the jobs are. So it's not, we shouldn't necessarily be tied to a particular academic credential, like a 4-year liberal arts degree or something like that. I mean, it might be that we're in an era where there might be more skills-based training and more flexibility and mobility in the workforce. So all those factors go into CBO's projections of productivity, and basically they come out to a point where they're saying, and this is not a value judgment on CBO's part, it's just saying, given what's happening, given policies, we're unlikely to see a big spurt in productivity that's going to substantially help with the long-term economic growth problem. Another one, there's a paper on productivity, on our research and development aimed at productivity. And there are some interesting recommendations in that about things that the federal government should be spending more money on to encourage research and development on things that the private sector might not have the incentives to invest in because of the possibilities of failure and the long-term, the long time it takes to pay off. So there may be things that the federal government should be doing more of in that area.
And Bob, I know you attended an event this morning that featured former Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen, and I'm just curious if she said anything relative to fiscal policy or economic growth that might be worth mentioning for today's conversation as we wrap up this segment.
Well, she did, as a matter of fact. She talked about unsustainable debt. Somebody asked her whether the public really appreciated the fact that the debt was on an unsustainable track, and she said no. And she said, as a matter of fact, it was a problem, and she recommended that everybody go out and read the CBO's long-term budget outlook, because that was that really lays it all out. And then in a more follow-up question, she got into some of the things that we've just been talking about, the changes in the workforce and the need to invest more in productivity. You know, she wasn't alarmist. She said that because we've got such low interest rates right now, there was perhaps less urgency in the sense of, the nation could carry a higher debt burden than we thought in previous years without it affecting things, because interest rates have been much lower than we thought. But she didn't think that that was a reason to just run up more debt, because eventually you've got to pay interest on that debt, and it becomes unsustainable. So she, as she has in the past, she certainly urged the public and policymakers to come up with things that will lead to a more sustainable future.
I'm actually sad I missed that event. This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. We've been discussing the CBO's baseline figures for the 10-year budget outlook and how they relate to the first term of the next president or the second term of President Trump, as well as some of the workforce productivity and growth figures within the baseline figures outlined by CBO, and just threw in a sprinkling of monetary policy and what our former Fed Chair Janet Yellen had to say about fiscal policy and economic growth. After the break, Ashley Hunt, a partner in LS2, an Iowa-based PR and government affairs firm, will join me and Bob to discuss the Iowa caucus. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Ashley Hunt from the LS2 Group in Iowa. Bob's a regular personality on the show. You just heard from him in our last segment. Ashley, you don't hear from quite as often. She's a partner at LS2, where she specializes in public affairs and digital media and event management. Prior to joining LS2, she worked at the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau and a Des Moines area public relations firm. Ashley also worked with the Concord Coalition, helping us with grassroots and outreach efforts a few years back. In this segment, I was hoping that we could talk a little bit about the results of the Iowa caucus, but as of yet, we don't have an announced victor, so I think we're going to have to engage in a little bit of election day pundancy, sort of like what we're seeing in all the news stations. We were originally going to talk about the victor and their fiscal policies and compare them to what we might see in the president's budget proposal next week, but obviously we can't do that. So Ashley, while we have you on the phone, maybe you can give us a little bit of an insight as to what's going on the ground in Iowa right now. And I would like to talk about your general experiences there and how the whole process works, because I'm in New Hampshire. Everything is very different. So take it away with what it's like right now in Iowa.
It's pure chaos right now. Things have been really crazy. So what's going on is the Republican, they held their caucus, got the results in right away. Their caucus is actually more like a straw poll, so it's a lot more simple. The Democratic side, they used a reporting app, a new one this year, and there was some trouble with the app. Party officials are saying there wasn't a hack or anything of the sort. It wasn't reporting all of the data completely accurately, but it was recording the data accurately. So they do not think there will be any inaccuracies once they are able to pull all of the data. Something new that the Democrats were doing this year was they were reporting all of the data rather than just the winner. And in order to explain that, I sort of need to explain how a Democratic caucus works. As I mentioned, on the Republican side, it's basically just a straw poll. When you get over to the Democratic side, your candidate has to have a certain amount of a threshold, a certain percentage of the votes, and so it's 15%. And so on the Democratic side, when you're caucusing, you go and you stand in a corner or sit at a table. All of the supporters of each candidate are there, coalesced together. And the caucus precinct leaders count up everybody and decide, okay, we have, you know, so and so many caucus goers here. In order to reach viability, you have to have 56, at least 56 people in your corner. And so they do the first alignment. Those candidates that do not reach the threshold are then asked to realign with a new candidate. That's when things get a little crazy, depending on the precincts. I saw some folks had, like, Girl Scout cookies that they were using to bring people over to their side, and things get a little creative. For the most part, once a candidate doesn't reach viability, their precinct leaders, their captains, will go around, staffers, will go around to the other corners and try to convince that candidate, supporters, to realign with them. Sometimes, so say Tulsi Gabbard didn't really have much, I don't think she was viable probably anywhere, and I don't know for sure, but let's say she was not viable in this caucus experience we're discussing. So her candidate or her supporters could all band together and say, oh, I'm going to now go to Pete Buttigieg. He's our second choice. Or they can all split up. So it gets a little crazy. It depends on each precinct. It's kind of hard to predict. That's why when you look at polls and those sort of things, they'll ask about second choices, and second choices are really important because if your candidate's not viable, the second choice could make or break the caucus. So they were, the Democratic Party was reporting not just the final, you know, candidates, but they wanted to report all of the percentages where each thing was in each alignment. And so there's extra data that had to be recorded, which was also something that caused an issue. Right now, it is noon in Iowa as of this discussion, and we still do not have results. So we're expecting to get the results, I've heard, in the next 4 hours. So right now the news cycle is not about who is winning, who comes out on top. It's not about the three tickets out of Iowa as it normally would be. It is about the failure of the Iowa caucuses and Iowa's perhaps not fit to be the first in the nation. That's basically what we're hearing right now.
I'd like to pick up on that, Ashley. This is Bob. I mean, I've been out there for the caucuses. I wasn't last night, but I was out there 4 years ago, as you recall, and you know, and in other cycles, and you know, one of the rites of passage there is after the votes come in, how quickly can you get to New Hampshire? Everybody floods to the airport and tries to get on private or commercial planes. And I really felt for everybody last night because they weren't quite sure what sort of a message to give. So it seemed to me that just about everybody declared victory at some point in the evening and off to New Hampshire. But it really was unfair to anybody that did well, and we'll find out later who it was. But you know, early reports seem to suggest that, you know, Sanders and Buttigieg and Warren all did relatively well. Not quite sure on Klobuchar or Biden, but we don't know. So, I mean, there's just like a cloud over the whole thing. And I wonder if it does put pressure on the Democratic Party to do a different kind of approach than the, dare I say, the Iowa-New Hampshire stranglehold on the first two. I mean, there's already been some talk about they're not the most demographically representative states in the country. And I'm just wondering if people in Iowa and Chase, even in New Hampshire, think this New Hampshire could be collateral damage here if people just sort of look at it as a package and wonder, is this the best way to do things?
Well, and I want Ashley to jump in on this too, but I think I do want to weigh in on that last point. And I have seen on social media and even in the news that it seems like if it wasn't already, the ground is cracking underneath Iowa in terms of being the first caucus in the nation. I don't know that I agree with that. Bob, you and I were talking about this offline earlier, but I'm sort of the opinion that I'm on the fence. You know, I don't know if I would rather see accurate data come out a day or two later or have a correction, you know, a week or two later when they have to flip who actually won the caucus and it upends, you know, some of the election results and delegates and that sort of thing. But I can definitely appreciate and respect that it's likely a gut punch to those, quote, lower tier candidates that might have been hoping for some momentum going into New Hampshire, and now they have to sort of create it. But Ashley, what's your take?
So Iowa, for sure, every caucus cycle receives criticism on whether we are right to be the first in the nation. Are we demographically, you know, representative? Are we too rural? Are we on the conservative side? Is it too social conservative? And then on the liberal side, are we too liberal? You know, what is it? And I will say leading up to this cycle, I have seen from national media more criticism than we saw last cycle. And each year, I think the state is receiving more criticism on whether or not it's the right choice for the first in the nation. And now, with this whole fiasco, I would not be surprised if there is a real effort to suspend Iowa as first in the nation. And what I'm hearing here on the ground is that that would mean New Hampshire be first in the nation and Iowa. Do we move to a primary? Do we keep our caucus? Who knows? But I think at this point, every Iowan is wondering what is going to happen in 4 years. And I think many Iowans will not be surprised if we are not first in the nation anymore.
So I guess I have a general question for both you and Bob is, has anything like this ever happened before? I know, Ashley, you're young like me, and Bob, you go back a little bit, and if anyone can hear that, that's my son in the background who's homesick today. No information has come out on results yet, and that seems in and of itself unprecedented. You would think at least some of the precincts would be reported if it's just a matter of verifying some of the information or certain precincts that might be larger or more difficult to calculate.
Well, the only results that I have seen is a Sanders staffer released some internal results with about 40% of precincts reporting, and they were, Sanders was ahead. As far as I know, this is unprecedented, and I'm not hearing of anything, any other time that this has happened. I mean, we do have, 2012 when the Republicans declared Mitt Romney the winner and then had to backtrack because it was actually Rick Santorum. So we've had the wrong results reported, but absolutely no results, especially now. No, I don't think that's ever happened. And I think the story coming out of here, as we talked about, is Iowa being unfit, and it's not about who came out first. And I don't know that the three tickets out of Iowa is going to make much of a difference in New Hampshire. I think even the winner, who would normally have momentum, I think this tarnishes their win, and I don't think that it gives them the boost that they're hoping for.
Yeah, I don't remember anything like it. It's always a little bit more cloudy than a primary, but I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, there are a lot of states that do caucuses. They're much more susceptible to breakdown because you got a process that can be confusing, and state party rules are not easy to follow, and you're adding up delegates that may be selected through some formula that is not obviously apparent to people who live outside of the state. And you can have people winning the popular vote, have the most people showing up at caucuses and yet not getting the most amount of delegates out of it. So it is confusing. On the other hand, it is a way for people to participate directly in the process. And it's kind of interesting that people have to make second choices and the horse trading that goes on and making compromises is kind of interesting to watch. But if at the end of the day you can't present a definitive result, then it fails the basic test of a representative system of government. And I think that's the major heart attack that happened last night. It's not just confusion over a few ballots here and there or a breakdown in one or two of the caucuses or even the breakdown in the app. You'd really think that 24 hours later you'd be able to have numbers produced or partial numbers. So it's bad.
And I'm not one to count my eggs before they hatch because, I like the Iowa-New Hampshire combination. It's always been a historic tandem. The primary has been pretty predictable in the sense that it typically goes off without a hitch, but, knock on wood, this could be the year, albeit the primary is not always predictable in terms of who's actually going to win because the fun twist in New Hampshire is our largest voting party is undeclared. So you've got this broad swath of people coming in and deciding which primary they're going to vote in on primary day, as opposed to, knowing, how many Republicans or how many Democrats are going to come in the door. And, that being said, Ashley, I know I cut you off, so definitely jump back in there and share what you wanted to say. But I was curious, do you like the caucus? Like you had a lot of interesting information to say about it in terms of how it works, but do you like that Iowa is a caucus state versus a primary?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it basically echoes what I was going to say, is that I would be remiss if we didn't discuss the positive side of having a caucus. as Bob mentioned, you know, that it's really interesting to think about the second choice, but I think caucuses really lend themselves to that grassroots real-tail politicking that you may not get with a primary. And I think people are they're thinking through all candidates because they do have to think through, at least on the Democratic side, they do have to think through who might their second choice be. And so if you get a primary, you walk in, you say, okay, I am going to vote for Joe Biden. That's it. I'm done. On the caucus side, you're like, okay, I'm going to vote for Joe Biden, but there's a possibility he's not viable in my precinct. So what do I do next? Well, I need to research the rest of the candidates. I need to meet the rest of the candidates to make my second choice. So I think it gives a really educated electorate, I guess, for lack of a better word. So I think that's a really good side of the caucuses. The other part I would like to say about Iowa, you know, I want to make sure, I feel like I've been negative about Iowa. I am very biased, and I love that Iowa is first in the nation, so I have to throw that out. And I think there's a lot of good things about Iowa being the first in the nation. One of those being, as we've mentioned, the tradition of Iowa and New Hampshire being the two firsts. Iowans are so used to having these opportunities. They're traditionally very educated, hyper-political. They know how to weigh their options. Do Iowans get a little selfish? Sure. And greedy when it comes to meeting candidates. But, again, they're used to it, and they know how to vet the candidates. And then, of course, the media, it's so much more cost-effective, and it gives those underdog candidates the chance to really rise. And if we move to perhaps a state that is more demographically representative, historically, those are going to be the states with larger urban centers, and the media market is going to be much more expensive. And a candidate like Pete Buttigieg might not get the bump that he was able to get because he was able to pay for airtime here in Iowa. And in Iowa, in the last 13 months, it was $63 million in presidential ads spent in our state, which is at some point a lot, but at another point it's not that much if you compare that to how much some of these candidates would have to pay in a larger urban area.
Yeah, and I think I would probably mirror a lot of those same sentiments actually about New Hampshire. Obviously, it's a bit different of a format, but a lot of the same, you know, principles, the very engaged electorate that likes to vet the candidates. There's the running joke that, you know, if one voter has to meet the same candidate seven times before they decide whether they'll vote for him or her in the primary. So I would be devastated if Iowa and New Hampshire lost their lead position in the primary and caucus process.
I think also we should talk about a little bit on the Republican side, because something that was interesting was the record turnout on the Republican side for an incumbent. The last caucus we saw with an incumbent president was with George W. Bush in 2004, and they say 8,000 approximately caucus goers showed up, and we're getting reports now that 32,000 people showed up for Republican caucuses last night. So there's, I think the news right now is all about what's going on in the Democratic side, but I think it's really interesting because that shows us the level of engagement that Republicans have for President Trump, and that I think is a clue to what we might see in the general election once we get past all of this caucus and primary mess.
Yeah, and this, you know, speaking as one who's been through the Iowa and New Hampshire process many times, as Ashley said, I mean, it really is good to begin the process in small states because it allows people to be viable. It allows lesser known candidates to make an impact by vigorous campaigning. It's not as expensive to campaign. You can be on the ground there. The voters take it very, very seriously in vetting these candidates. And so, you know, maybe I'd certainly be open to some way of improving the demographic profile of the opening states. But whatever they do, I think it's very, very important to begin in an arena that as many candidates as possible can compete.
So I apologize to you, Ashley and Bob, and our listeners as I'm coping with the realities of being a new parent and having a sick infant at home. But this is Facing the Future. We've been talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, as well as Ashley Hunt, a partner with LS2 in Iowa. We've been talking a lot about what's been going on
on the ground in the Iowa caucus, a little bit of the history there, and what to expect leading into New Hampshire. Thank you both for joining the show.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.